Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode 69 of Productivity Mastery, the podcast that I'm leading, Stoyan Yankov, productivity coach. And I'm here to bring you some of the best, the most inspiring leaders, the best performers out there. And you guys today are going to have a little threat, not a little threat, you're going to have a great threat because I brought you one of the most impactful business leaders of our time, a living legend, Joe Foster, the founder of the legendary iconic brand Reebok. Everyone who's listening has some piece of clothes or sneakers or maybe many, but I'm here with Joe Foster and we're going to discover the story behind building this global brand. Joe, how are you this morning?
Well, thank you, Stone. What a nice introduction. And this morning, I'm fine. It's great. The weather's good and sun's shining. So why should we not be fine? It's good. And thank you for the invitation. It's going to be very interesting.
I'm very humbled and honored to have you here. And by the way, everybody who's tuning in right now, if you're listening, if you share this live stream, you get a chance to get one of the three copies of Joe Foster's new book. Joe, would you show us the book? I know you have a copy next to you.
I know. Here we are. This there is you it. Go. Shoemaker.
Shoemaker. This book, the paper copy, is actually coming out today. So you're going to be one of the first people that will receive a paper copy of the book. And I can't wait to dive into this. Joe, why don't you tell us what was the reason to actually write this book?
Well, the reason was that the family, the Foster family, had been involved in sports footwear from the invention of the spike track shoe in 1895 by my grandfather, and right up to present day. I retired in the end of 1989 and took it easy, laid back, watched the world go by and enjoy life a bit with a lot of my friends. But then, you know, the computer, Wikipedia, Google, these things start to grow, and I'm reading. This is the way that Reebok started. Reebok just changed its name from Jade. We've had so many stories that were wrong, totally wrong. There was even a photograph on Wikipedia. This is Joe Foster, founder of Reebok, and I've no idea who that person was at all. So I was thinking, come on, we've got to do something here. Maybe if I sit down and write a book and tell the story, maybe enough people will read that. So now the mission is to get it to number one, and then people will know how Reebok started, where it came from, the origins of the family, the J.W. Foster family business, and where that came from. So that was the reason for writing the book.
And could you maybe give us a little bit of a context of... I listened to the book... already a couple of times on the audio version, and I found it really, really a brilliant business book, but it has also a lot of personal stories, a lot of lessons in between the lines. And if you can maybe lead us through the beginnings of the company. So as you were explaining in the book, you had to leave the company, the family company, and start your own with your brother. So could you maybe share this part of the story? Why did you guys decided to actually start on your own?
Well, of course, as I just mentioned earlier, 1895, my grandfather invented or certainly pioneered spike running shoes. And that was the start of his business. And he had world records posted in his shoes in 1904, as early as that. We had World War I, but in the 1920s, he had an era where he provided shoes for every Olympian and so many gold medals. But those early days, people didn't know about that. Only athletes knew about that. He died in 1933, and I was born in 1935. But I was born on his birthday. So 15 months after he died, I was born on his birthday. This is why I had to be called Joe Foster as well. He was Joe Foster, I'm called Joe Foster. And I'm born 4 years before World War II. So once again, the company has plunged into a war. Nobody needs running shoes. Its army boots are being made and repaired. It's 1945, I'm 10 years old, the war is over, and I probably start a different childhood. So, again, great, but socializing was very localized around the local churches and things. That was how social. So, okay, this is fine. And I have an education. I go to college and my education is more engineering than footwear. And at 17, I actually come into the J.W. Foster business, which is now in the hands of my father and uncle. So they're taking on the business from their father. And 1 year, I didn't take much notice, just 1 year in the business. And then at 18, we had to go, both Jeff and I had to go to do national service, which was 2 years in the armed forces, a relic of the wartime. We had to do this 2 years. And that 2 years made a difference. Because no longer is mother doing your washing, making your meals, doing all the things for you. You're no longer part of the family. You have to look after yourself. You learn discipline, and you learn to be self-sufficient. So it's a different life. And Jeff had gone to Germany. He did his national service in Germany. He saw Adidas. He saw Puma. So we come back after 2 years, and we come back to a business. And this now our eyes are open. We're not just part of something which is expected. Now we step back in and look and we see a failing business. My father and uncle just didn't get on together. There's about 6 years between them, and they were feuding, a bit like Adi Dassler and Rudi Dassler. They feuded, but Rudi left and set up Puma. This didn't happen at Foster's. They just kept feuding and feuding. And we tried. I tried to talk to father, so I say, look, we've got to change. You've got to work together. We need a plan. We need to develop our business. It didn't work. My father would say to me, look, when I'm gone and Bill's gone, that was my uncle, when we're gone, it'll be your business. You can do what you like with it. Oh. And I'm saying, Dad, but you know, we don't want you to go. That's not the plan. But this business will be dead long before you are. And it still didn't make any difference. So Jeff and I had to make plans, and we prepared ourselves. And in 1958, we left the business. We had to, in order to, well, our future, I suppose. And, you know, I'm 23. Jeff is 25. What's to lose? We're not old. We're young. It doesn't matter. We're indestructible. You know, we can do anything. Yeah. So what? So we were young enough to do this. I know today, and I've known for many times, I look back on that time and think, oh, would you do it now? And no, you need to be young. You need to be young and take the risk. You can afford it and when you're young. So that's when we left the business, and that's why we left the business. We moved 6 miles away from the parent business and set up in the next town, and we set up as Mercury Sports Footwear. So that's why we set up our own business.
And I just want to just stop here for a moment. And was it difficult to face your father and to share the news on, you know, me and my brother, we are starting our own thing? And, you know, for the audience, maybe how did he take it? And how was this experience for you trying to, you know, working for your father for many years, and now you have to tell him the news?
Well, yes. I mean, why he didn't expect it, I don't know. Maybe he did. But I walked into the office on a Friday evening in November of 1958, and Jeff insisted I did it. That's why I got the blame for the whole thing. But I walked in and said, Dad, look, you know, it's not working for us here. Nothing's happening. So Jeff and I are leaving the company. We're setting up on our own. He didn't seem to be listening. So I said, did he hear me? And he turned around and said, yeah. And he picked up a letter opener, which is like a sharp pointed knife, and walked towards me. And I'm wondering what's he going to do. But he turned it around and gave it to me and said, right, stab me now. And, you know, the feeling is, no, this is not what it's about. It's about the future, not ending something. It's about the future. But I just took it off him, put it down on the table, turned around and walked out. I don't think we spoke for 2 years, but eventually we did get together again because he did realize, I think after 2 years, the foster business, my uncle had died and the foster business didn't continue. And he saw we were doing all right. We were doing good. I think he then realized that possibly he hadn't been thinking straight. But, you know, my uncle had gone through two world wars. And I wonder, had they got the spirit left? You know, they're probably in the early 50s when World War II is over. And I'm thinking, you know, did that take away their spirit? Is this why they didn't get on and couldn't see that they were now running a business, not just earning a living? Maybe. I don't know. I probably never will know, but it's probably a good thing I don't know that story. But Jeff and I, we set up on our own small factory in Bury.
And was it your ambition in the book you're sharing that you've been having this drive and this ambition? Was it your ambition that was driving the process? Because as far as I remember, your brother Jeff, he was not as ambitious as you at the time.
Well, I don't. I probably think he was as ambitious, but he wasn't as vocal. He didn't express it as much, and he would much rather I did the talking. So yes, I got the blame for it. But Jeff was absolutely 100% there, no question. But Jeff loved the factory. He just liked making shoes and doing the development work, processing them. So he loved that. And I guess that it was a good thing that I probably didn't like the idea of repetition, of making shoes, of just doing the same time and again. I did designing. I did most of our designing. And then I did the marketing and everything else that was needed in those early days until it slowly came down to just, well, I just really marketing the company and doing the advertising. And Jeff just run the factory, but we never had a bad word, whatever. And I did some stupid things. I must have done a lot of stupid things. But he tolerated that. he didn't worry. No, I think maybe that I'm away and we're not under each other's feet. A bit like father and uncle, they worked in the same space. We didn't work in the same space. So maybe that was a good reason why we never fell out. We never had a bad word. It did. In the early days, we did work together, and you know, I'd probably work maybe 50% in the factory and 50% trying to build a business, and that separated. But Jeff loved the factory, and I did the rest.
I love it. One of you is more the entrepreneur, seeing opportunities, being the visionary, doing the sales, and the other one is more like the artist, more like focused on the product, on the design, and having the natural tendency. We had this with Joe. When the headphones stopped working, he will give me a sign like this. So now he's going to set it up. Not yet. It's still down. No. Meanwhile, while we're waiting for Joe, I just want to remind you, everybody, that if you share the stream, if you share this live stream on LinkedIn and on YouTube, you get a chance to get one of the...
Can you hear? Yes, thumbs up. I can hear me now.
Thumbs up for Julia.
Yeah, Julia. I'm going to have to cut this off, you know, and just join it so that I don't have a volume control. It catches against the chair down here. And I, as I said, I move around and I obviously cut it off. It's part of the entertainment. This is part of the show, people.
Hey look, that's a live show.
I do this all the time.
And it's a good reminder for everybody that you can today go and get a copy of Joe Foster's book, the whole story, all the details, all the good, the bad, and the ugly. Shoemaker, I already listened to it twice. And if you share the stream, if you share the live stream on LinkedIn, you get a chance to get one of three coffees that I'm going to give away for the listeners of Productivity Mastery. But let's get back on track, Joe.
Right.
Let's get back on track. I have a question about... maybe if you can share with with the audience, there's a lot of startup founders listening, a lot of entrepreneurs, and many of these early stage founders, because I work with a lot of founders myself as part of my job. And we ask them, what is the vision for your company, for example, right? And they say, in 3 years, we are the leading provider of this, and we're going to make a $5 billion exit to Amazon. And we kind of paint the picture that success is easy, right? Because we look at these five super successful people who made it for maybe a long time, but we only see the positive side of the thing. And I want you to maybe share a little bit, what does it really take to win and succeed? Like how many hours have you been working weekly? All the effort, all the sacrifices, like what does it really take? What did it take you and Jeff to take the company, to lift it off the ground?
Well, I think when you are an entrepreneur and when you decide you're going to do something, you have to have a passion for it. You have to be in love with it. It's something that you're married to it. It's, you know, it's what you do, and the demand of that company, you just turn up. When it's demanded, you turn up, whatever it is. And I like when you say people have this idea of in 3 years. I love making business plans. And why do I love making business plans? Because 3 months after I've made the business plan, I look at it and I say, why on earth did I think I'd do that 3 months ago? It's, yeah, we're nowhere near that. And if you look at it after 12 months, by the way, 12 months is too late to look at your business plan again. You've got to look at it at least every 3 months, because you find out that you had this in mind. I'm going to do this, this, and this. And whatever happens, it hardly goes the way your business plan is. But the good thing about that is you know where you're going wrong. You know if you're thinking one way and it's going another, start changing your thinking until you get more on track with your business plan. But don't worry about a business plan. Just put it down there, because that's your ambition. That's your drive. That's where your future is. And you know, keeping your eyes closed and keeping down that track, which is probably the wrong track. So the business plan is good, but you know, don't take too much notice. Be ready to change it. And as you were saying, what does a business, it takes everything, really. And well, we started in 1958, and it was 1979. We're 20 years on. It took 20 years of hard slog, lots of problems, before we got to a point where I got to the American market, the market I really wanted to get into, because that's a volume. That's where the numbers are. But it took 20 years of trying. It took 11 years of going to America to the NSGA show and turning up and trying to find a distributor. And I had at least six failures. And I can probably write them down, from Clifford Severn to somebody called Parnell, Graham Parnell. I had a number of attempts. And Shu Lang, oh, he's in my book pretty seriously. I learned an awful lot with I think we tried for about 3 years using Shu Lang. And he tried very hard. And we exchanged letters. Some of those letters are incredible. You know, this is going wrong, this is going wrong. And then, wow, this is good. But it was such an up and down story. But it took a long time. So you've got to be ready for the long run. And I think now people, in fact, when they start out in business, they always look for what is the end game, for how they can finish it out and get out. But that seems to be part of a business. I think when Jeff and I started the business, is how do we make the company successful? Not how do we get out? What are our ambitions? And they were never to be the number one sports brand. But we did get to the number one sports brand. But that was never our initial ambition. I think initially it was, how do we make a living? How can we sort of do better than our parents? And then you gain a little bit sort of experience, and you think, oh, we can go better. We can. And so gradually you get the feeling, you get the confidence that, yes, we can take this further. Yes, we must take it further. And I had so many experiences in those days. We didn't have computers. We didn't have mobile phones. All I had was a handful of American Express traveler's checks, and I'd jump on a plane and go somewhere, usually to the exhibitions, and then I'd make acquaintances, and then I'd have to go off and see them. So it's building relationships with people, and in a lot of ways, you know, building those relationships are really important. I had one in the early days with a man called John Willie Johnson, who had a rather large footwear factory about 15 miles away from where we'd set up. And that guy was so helpful. In those days, all the shoe industry was moving to the Far East. And so there were a lot of companies going out of business, and they had auctions. We used to go to the auctions because they're auctioning off the machinery. And that's where I met him. And we developed a great relationship. And he had a lot of machinery. And I saw one in his warehouse. John, I could do with that machine. And I said, can I buy it? He said, no. I said, oh, can I rent it then? And he said, no. Oh, okay, John. He said, you can have it. Oh, right. He said, give it me back when you finish with it. Okay, John. And not only did he give me the machine, his men, his team, brought it down, fixed it into our factory, set it up. Those are the sort of relationships you need, that sort of association. And, you know, I was able to build a number of those that when we needed help, it's not somebody saying, well, that will cost you £1,000. No, it was given. And, you know, we needed that so much in those early days. So relationships, persistence, you know, when you're small and you can't afford things, you need help and you need the guidance of those people to help you along the road. But, you know, you've got to keep going.
And Joe, you mentioned building relationships. Could you share some secrets with us? What helped you to build these strong relationships, this trust with people? What were some of the things that really worked for you during the years?
Well, you know, you meet people and you make a judgment. You either like them or not. And if you like them, you work with them and you can see that. Now, not everything works. I have a great faith in people. And I find that probably 90% of the time that's worked for me. But there are people who've let me down, and you will find that. But you know, it's having faith in your fellow beings. You've got to have that faith. If you're always suspicious of everybody you meet, I think you'll never go forward. You have to take a chance. A bit like the ABBA song, take a chance on me.
In a way, you start with trust by default, right? Yes. Like your default is, I trust you 100%, and you let people do what they do. And obviously at some point you can change your mind, but the initial point is the default is, I trust you, I give you my trust, and let's take it from there.
Yes, I think if you show trust and you show that faith in somebody, that 90% of the time it does pay off. Not all the time. It's like, you know, employing people with talent is good. Employing people with ego is bad. You know, you can sometimes find that these people have more ego than talent. But you know, you usually find when you're employing people or you're taking people in to help you, they're the ones that come to you. You know, putting an advert in somewhere and then trying to interview. I think I probably interviewed two people in my whole career. The rest of the people that actually came in, I didn't need to look for them. They were looking for me. And I think that's the best way. You get, you know, really you don't need the most talented people. You need the most the people who are really going to be eager, good, with passion. If they have passion, okay, that's the thing that takes them that, you know, that extra step, that extra mile. I think people with talent tend to be, and you probably read the stories. I don't know if you listen to Sneakonomics. Sneakonomics is a podcast that's put out by the BBC. I think you can find it on Twitter. On Spotify, you can find it. And iTunes. It's an incredible, it's about 9 episodes. I'm in 2. But really, it's a big fight between, first of all, the Dasslers, how they fought each other, and then Adidasler and Nike. So it was Adidas and Nike, their fight, and the dirty tricks. You know, amazing. It's well worth a listen if you're very interested in what builds a business and how the sports business has been built into what is now a 50 billion business between Adidas, Nike, and a few other people. So, you know, it's incredible. And the people, you get to pick up on some of the real loyal people, some of the talented people, but how loyal they are. And you know, this is what you experience when as your company gets bigger, it needs a lot of people. And you need them to be able to work on their own and to take the company forward.
And this is such an important point. And actually, I want to we have a number of questions coming. I want to ask the first question coming from Gabriel Bogdanova. Hello, Gabriel. Thank you for being with us today. And she's first saying, thank you for being so authentic. Joe, would you share what are some of the most critical core values and principles that you have followed from the very beginning of your personal and leadership journey, and they have never let you down?
Thank you, Gabriel. That's a nice big question. I think that your core principles are you have to be honest. You have to be true. You have to, when you say something, you have to mean it. Don't be deceptive. If people deceive you, they deceive you. But, you know, that is a risk you take being in control of a business. So it's always greet people as we were talking. You know, give them the benefit of any doubt. Trust them. But you yourself have got to be seen to be honest, to be straightforward, and to believe. Now, if you believe, you've also got to show that passion, because you have to be passionate. You've got to create a winning culture. If you create that winning culture, it really is surprising how many people come to you. It looks like bees around a honey jar. It's something that attracts people. And we built that winning culture. That, you know, we're always going forward. We look at things that we can win that. Yes, we can do it. So we're optimism. Optimism has got to be part of it. And you just have to be authentic. Yeah, when people see you, they know that when they talk to you, you know, you're not telling them stories. You may be saying something beyond where we are, but that's the ambition. You know, we're saying, yes, we're going to do this. Yes, we can do that. So it's having a very creative attitude. And, you know, when you do take people on, I think you've probably heard the story, if you're the brightest person in the room, you're in the wrong room, which is correct, because you need bright people. You need people who can move things forward, do things differently. Why employ somebody in a fairly serious position unless they can do it better than you are? So it's being open for that. You've not got to be the person that seems that they know it all and that you're just coming to assist. No, what you're coming to do is to take the lead. And because you're in a position where you can give people that, they've got to believe in you.
Gabriel, I hope you enjoyed this answer. And I want to stay on the topic, Joe. As I showed you before the podcast, we just finished and published our own book recently with Mike Holter, which is actually on the topic that you just discussed, Perform, right. The Unsexy Truth About Startup Success.
Yes.
We spoke too much about the shiny stuff. But one of the things I'm really excited about, we talk a lot about in the book, we interviewed over 50 people, founders, entrepreneurs, and many of them shared a similar thing. Specifically, I remember now the founder and CEO of a company called Miro, which is now this whiteboard company, all right, growing really steadily. What he said is, he said, day one is the right time to start talking about values and defining the culture within the team. Sort of like designing the culture by intention, as opposed to letting the culture evolve. I'm actually curious to hear what's your take on that, because you said it a few times already, it's about the people we attract, people who have this winning attitude, people who have shared the same values. But how did you guys define the culture and define the values in the early days so you can afterwards attract people who are aligned with the same type of values and way of doing things?
Well, I think in our very early days, of course, there were just two of us. You know, we're trying to build a business, so we're looking at really succeeding. So success is the first thing. So we need to win, and that need to win means you don't win everything, but you know, the next race we're going to win, and we're going to improve. So it's personal improvement. It's improving our business. It's relating to our business. It's, you know, I used to go out in a car to sell. I went around to the local sports stores. They don't exist anymore. They're now big sports stores. Now, I used to go to the, usually run by an ex-footballer who finished his football days, and now he ran the local sports shop. So these guys, and I would go in there and say, here I am, I've got Reebok. And he'd look at me and say, Reebok, who's Reebok? And I'd give him a story of who we are, and he'd look up on his shelf and say, I've got Adidas and I've got Dunlop. Why do I need Reebok? A very important question for me. Why do I need Reebok? And I realized he didn't need Reebok. That the people who needed Reebok were the athletes, the consumers. So I had to get to the consumers direct. So we start to build that association, and that builds the value. You know, I couldn't say that I ever thought that we were building value in our company right at day one, but I did realize that once we started to deal with people, we did build value, and we did think of, you know, people have got to look at us and think we're the best. Or when we buy Reebok because they are the best. They're not just selling a product. You know, they're selling us something we can win with. And I think that it starts then that you start to learn the fact that your name, your company, your integrity is so important. And you've got to believe in it. And as you believe in that, you actually sell that company to other people. You sell your ideas and your belief. And it is absolutely part of the belief, the integrity. And you show that. You know, we had a lot of problems. I had a very simple one. Now, the north of England is very wet, usually. It rains a lot. And our runners would go out on wet days and go on cross fields. And, you know, we did recognize the fact that if your shoe was either white or blue, you would sell them. Any other color was a bit, didn't work. So we made these blue shoes, nice blue suede. People going out in the wet, they were coming home, taking the shoes off, and the sock, they would have a nice sock, or even the foot, was blue. It had taken on, the dye that was in the leather had gone into the socks. Oh, the athletes themselves were not that worried, but their wives, they were saying, look at this, now we've got blue socks. We were a bit destroyed, blue, all these blue socks and people complaining. So we went to the tannery where we got our leather from, said, look, what's happened? What's over there? Oh, they apologized. They'd forgotten to wash out the excess dye when they dyed the leather. So we were having problems. So what did we do? Any athletes that came by, and we actually advertised and say, you know, if you've got a pair of our shoes and they're turning your socks blue, please send them back. We will replace them. And we'll also send you some socks, which we did. But, you know, we sent them blue socks. So we sent them on, and they loved it. And the wives loved it. You know, instead of turning the white socks blue, now we sent them blue socks. So it's, yeah, you turn around. It's a very simple situation, but you know it can be very annoying to some people. You're out there and the socks turn blue. So yeah, it's actually getting into your business, being part of it. You know, you really know what you're doing. You're just not a shoemaker and suddenly socks turn blue. No, you're providing athletes with a product, and that product, it's got to be right. And if it isn't right, you know, and you're not right all the time, it's whatever way you do. Like I say, I made many mistakes, and probably Jeff was probably mad at me, but never said so at some of the things I did. But, you know, you've got to have the answer. And so you build the value in your company. You build that. And yes, you do start to realize that, look, the name of the company, you've got to have it totally respected. People have got to believe in you and believe that your company has that value, you know, has something that they can rely on.
And by the way, we have another person tuning in, Loretta, who's saying, my first Reebok was blue.
I hope she didn't get blue socks.
Amazing. Joe, I listened to, when I was preparing for the podcast, I listened to another podcast you did in, and you shared something, I think, really important. I'm not sure about the exact words, but you said something around the lines of, as an entrepreneur, you should expect failure. Don't, and then the second part to it was, don't take too much advice from people. could you talk to me about these things?
Well, I think if you don't expect failure, and I think if you just work on advice, you actually become a professional something of whatever it is, and you work in that profession doing numbers or whatever. I think if you're an entrepreneur, you're a little bit different. You like to not think you're following a trend, but you're creating one. And to create something, somebody who knows how to create a trend isn't going to tell you how to create a trend. They're going to tell you the problems of doing things. So you've got to have belief. Just have belief. And, you know, whilst you're not looking to fail, just be prepared. You know, the things will happen. You could fail. You'll certainly have a lot of problems on the road. If you don't have problems, then goodness me, I don't know where and how you manage to do that. But yeah, some people maybe, and you know, also as you develop, you forget your problems. This is a good thing about being an entrepreneur and being an optimist. The problems disappear. At the time when you face them, you know, and as I said, when going to America, I failed at least 6 times. I'd have to pull back and start again. Fortunately, it wasn't the business that failed. It was just the attempts to get into America. But yes, accept failure and don't listen to too much advice. Don't listen too much to me. I can't give you much advice except believe in yourself. Yeah. Believe in yourself. And if you've got the passion, you'll get there because it's passion that wins. Yeah, the talent... You know, you'll find the talent, you'll find the product, but you need a product you can believe in. You know, we didn't invent. Maybe my grandfather invented the spike running shoe, but we didn't invent that much. We did a few little sort of nice touches which were different than others, and you know, you bring out later on when we were quite big. You know, the pump. I mean, that I think is a fantastic innovation, but it's more of an innovation than an invention because we're just pumping air and, you know, everybody's been blowing tires up on the cars for centuries almost. So you're not really inventing, you're just using, you're just adapting. So you know, the thing is, what you do invent and what you do create is belief. People believe that you've got a product. We were not the fanciest product in the world when we were starting off. But, you know, our product worked. It worked. It did its job. And people and says, oh, this has fallen apart. No, they worked. They may not have been the prettiest of shoes, although I believe they were. But but above and beyond that, they worked. I believed in it. And, you know, if you believe in it yourself. So it is the most important thing is, you know, don't worry about failure. Put it in your mind that, this may not work. But we won't have a go at it. But believe in it. And if you can sell the passion that you have, you'll find out that the failures just drop away. You know, you persuade somebody, this is not a failure. You know, we can make it.
I had a client once. He was a startup founder, and he came to me, and he was really concerned. And he was like, Stoyan, how do I motivate people who are consistently underpaid? because when you start a company, right? When you start a startup, usually you cannot afford to pay what the corporates are going to. So the passion that you're talking about, the passion, the purpose, the bigger picture, the vision. And another person who actually we featured in the book, she said she's the CEO of Thunderbeam, She said, as a CEO, you are the chief motivation officer.
Absolutely.
Like every day you got to be there, and no matter how bad things are, you cannot play the victim, right? You need to shield your team and be there for them. So, but Joe, one thing I haven't asked you yet, I'm super curious. I know the story a little bit, but I'm sure many of the audience don't know the story. How did you came up with the name Reebok?
Yeah, well, it's it was quite early on in our time. We started, as I mentioned earlier, we started Mercury Sports Footwear, and we were probably 18 months, 2 years into our business. And yes, we were doing nicely, thank you. We were actually making money, selling shoes, and a good job. And our accountant, he came and said, Joel, you're doing quite nicely. You better register your name. Well, I'm sorry, we're a bit young. Why do we need to register a name? Be naive on this. Yeah? We're making sport. Well, he's saying you'll find that if you're making a good job, somebody might start copying you, making Mercury shoes. Oh, right. Okay. And then if they start making Mercury shoes, you're going to have to go to court. You're going to have to sit down there and prove that you own the name, because you started off with that. And that's going to cost you money. People can take you to court and say, no, that, because big companies can decide they just like to copy something just to make money. Okay. So what do? Well, you go to the registrar and register Mercury. Of course, went to the registrar, and what did we find? Mercury is already registered. We couldn't own it. Well, we could. They offered it to us for £1,000. I think it was British Shoe Corporation, and they weren't using it. They just had it registered. So, we couldn't afford £1,000 to buy it. So I went to see a patent agent in Manchester, the biggest local city. And it's a day in May, and he had his window open, and he said, "So you can't buy Mercury, you've not got the money." So he said, "Bring me a new one." And he pointed through the window and to a sign, Kodak. I said, what's with Kodak? And he said, "Well, it's invented, it means nothing. So they made it up, it's their name. That's the ones, they're the ones easiest to register." Okay, he said, "But don't bring me one name. We've got to put a few through the register." He said, "One at a time, and you'll find it's 12 months before you've got anywhere if you're doing these ones. Bring me 10 names. Oh, well, I don't know, Stoyan, if you sat down and tried to think of a name for something. And, well, it goes through, and you get some. It's actually quite fun at sometimes, because you come up with some weird names, really. And we did. We come up with Cougar, Falcon, something aggressive, something that sounded like, oh, sports company, get on with it. But I'll take you back during the war in 1943. I'm 8 years old. And I go to a local event, and I win a race. I think it was 60 meters, something like that. And I go up to get my prize. I'm 8 years old. I go up to get my prize. And what is it? It's a dictionary. And I'm sort of, where's the football? But a dictionary? I'm 8 years old, And they give me a dictionary. And more than that, it was an American dictionary. Oh. In fact, Sneakonomics, episode 2, they've dramatized that. And it's funny, you should read it. I found it funny too. It's an American dictionary. Why?
What do we do with it?
Move forward to 1960, and we're looking for a new name. And I pick up my American dictionary. I like the letter R. I thought, let's have a look at letter. So I open up at letter R, and I'm thumbing through the pages from letter R. It doesn't take long to get to R-E. And it's R-E-E-B-O-K. Oh, Reebok. Well, that sounds good. What is it? It's a small South African gazelle. Gazelle? What? Now we're talking. That sounds like a sports company to me. Reebok. Took it to the agent, took with the rest of the names, and it was the only one that came out that we could use. Reebok. And the only objection the registrar had, "We have to put you in Part B," he said, "because if anybody comes to us and said we're making shoes out of Reebok skin, we can't stop them." Well, Jeff and I thought, what's the chance of that? However, so we registered Reebok. 20 years later, the registrar came back and said, "We moved to Part A of the register." And why? He said, "Because everybody now knows that Reebok is a shoe, not an animal." So that's how we got Reebok. from a dictionary, an American dictionary, one in 1943 when I was an eight-year-old.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It's like when you hear these stories and everybody, you know, kind of assumes that, I don't know, everything is just so strategic and like there's a team of 20 people working on it's like a dictionary you won when you were 8 years old. Luckily you won, otherwise maybe the name would have been I don't know, like an alligator from Asia.
Yeah, this is the good fortune of people. You have your good fortune. We, you know, and failure can sometimes bring that. You know, it's the obstacle. The obstacle was you can't use mercury. But you know, and it pushed us in a different way. And the good fortune is we came out with a better name. We came out with a much more memorable name, and it's been great. Yeah, these things happen. Adidas telling us we can't use our two stripes and T-bar. No, so we come up with a different one, a vector, and it's and there are many stories. It's like the I don't know if you picked up on the window box that we put into our side stripe. The you know we had the Reebok and the Union Jack in. That came out because I was driving a Saab car at the time. And I got on well with the guy with the Saab garage in Manchester. And Saab was sponsoring Sebastian Coe, Seb Coe. We all know now he's head of the IAF, IWF. And, but he was a Nike man. And they wanted me to make a shoe for Seb Coe. And I said, come on, he's Nike. We can't make him a Reebok shoe. He said, well, can you make one with Saab? Can we put Saab on? I said, well, maybe. Went to his office, came out with some Saab labels they put on clothing. I said, can you use these? Oh, I said, give it to me and I'll see. I'm driving back and I think, how can I use this? And I thought, well, maybe if I cut a square out of the side stripe and put the Saab thing underneath, maybe we can do that. Wow, it worked. It worked really well. The next thing, I'm on the telephone to the people who supply our labels. I need a label. Tell them exactly what I wanted, and that's how the window on the Reebok shoes came out, because somebody asked me to make a shoe for Seb Coe. So all these little things that you know, we wouldn't have done it otherwise. We'd have been like everybody else and gold foil stamped all the time, just stamp it on the side. But you know, it made that little difference, especially when we went to aerobics, because it was an all white shoe with just this little window box and the color in that, and the women love that. Just loved it.
Beautiful. And you mentioned Nike, and I'm actually curious, what was your relationship with your competitors? Like, did you meet the leaders from Nike, from Adidas, from the other brands, or like, was it this friendly competition, or were there a lot of, what do you call it, like kicks under the table? And like, what was the relationship you guys have?
Well, if you listen to Sneakonomics, you'll find out what relationships were. However, not for me. We used to sneak on the Adidas stand at the exhibition shows. We used to sneak on the one of our retailers would take us in as part of his outfit, and we used to do that. And in the earlier the days, whilst Phil Knight was still Blue Ribbon, they were just starting to make Nike shoes. I never met Phil Knight, but I met Jeff Johnson. And Jeff Johnson, if you've read all the books, he was the one that came up with the word Nike. He was really the inspiration behind the brand. Phil Knight, he was an accountant. Bill Bowman, he was a very respected coach. And so that's where the energy came from. But it was Jeff Johnson who was the ideas man. And we had a long conversation, great conversation, and it was great. And I knew if I met him any time whilst we were growing Reebok and Nike, if I met him at any time, I could have a good, pleasant chat. It was nice chat. Yeah. So, yes, a lot of underhand sort of things went on. I met Horst Dassler once. I never met Adi Dassler, only the once. But Horst, he was probably the most deceptive, and he sort of had a way of growing the brand. And again, Sneakonomics, you learn a lot about that with that. But I found most of the time that the people I met in, whether it be Adidas or Nike or other brands, it was always nice to speak. Davis of New Balance, what was his first name? I've forgotten his first name. But, you know, we used to have a chat. Yeah, how are things going? So I think there were a lot of underhand things maybe went out on some fairly suspicious events. But by and large, for me, no. I got on very well, and we had just nice lengthy discussions.
Beautiful. And I just want to remind everybody who's listening, who's watching us live, the new book of Joe Foster, Shoemaker, is out right now. Joe, maybe you can show it again.
Here we go.
Shoemaker is out. And it's you can get a copy at this webpage, jwfosterheritage.com. And if you share this live stream, we're going to check it out, and we're going to give away three books. Productivity Mastery Podcast is going to give away three signed copies of the book, which we just arranged with Joe. So make sure to share the stream. And if not, obviously, go get a copy. The book is excellent. The book is amazing. I listened to it twice. One of my favorite business books to date. I'm not just making it up. It's a really, really humble, really practical, lots of personal stories, leadership lessons in between the lines. And I think we can now take a few more questions, because the audience has been really, really excited about having you here, Joe. Veselin Tonov is having a question for you. The question is, how did you make decisions regarding marketing in order to keep the message fresh and up to date, but still in alignment with the core values of the brand and without making a compromise with its identity?
I think with marketing, it's a matter of opportunities, and opportunities do come along. And usually, you're now talking about influencers, because marketing moved away from just simply advertising and having a new idea. Marketing moved onto the street. We all became fashion brands, and you know, now sport brands are fashion brands. It is the street. So it's influencing, and it's picking the right influences. Nike used to pick up some quite dodgy things, some, you know, McEnroe, a bit sort of edgy. But you know, being edgy is good. You know, and if you could pick up something edgy, fine. You know, but otherwise, your influencer has to really be somebody who was an influencer, like Shaquille O'Neal, and then maybe the invention. And I think it was Dee Brown who was seen pumping up his shoes when Reebok came out with the pump, pumping them up, and then in a competition doing a slam dunk, those sort of things. So your marketing has got to be it's sports driven, but it's also now driven by entrepreneurs. Yeah. And it's more and more. So it's aligning up. It's Kanye West with Adidas, you know, and Yeezy. It's like, how do you get the street to take your brand? And it's those brands. Air Jordan. That was the first big thing for Nike. Separate brand almost. But the marketing is lining up with the right influence. An influence in these days, it not necessarily is it an athlete, and but it's good to stay. If you want to stay as part of a sports brand, which is fashion, then you need probably to have a few top athletes as well to do that. And of course, both Adidas and Nike, past experts are doing that. But that's their marketing. That's the underlying marketing. The rest, of course, is like we say, is finding an influencer. But influencing, that's marketing. And like we say, you influence by using sport. And that's the way you keep your core value. Your core value is you're in sport. You have to have performance products. A lot of people now make very similar products. They have the sporting look, but they may be a designer brand. They have that. But if you want your core brand, you have to have people perform in your product. But to get the volume, I get the street, you really need to get the influencers.
Great. Veselin, I hope you enjoyed this answer. And we have a question coming also from Razvan. Razvan Sura, a lot shorter than the others. So what he's asking is, at what point in your journey you were the happiest, and what triggered that?
You know, I think really it's probably I could put that the opposite way around, because being happy is the only way you can run a business. Being enthusiastic, being passionate, that's the way to run your business. So happiness is what you do. That is happiness. There are the odd disappointments that are the things that go wrong, the things you can't change. One of those was when my brother Jeff died just as we got into America. So we're always on a high. We're always doing things right. We're always a leading product. We always have a smile on our face. We're always happy. There are times which are exceptional. You know, we did in Monte Carlo, we did the tennis tournament for Memorial of Princess Grace, and all the people from Hollywood come along, and you think, wow, this is fantastic. You know, Frank Sinatra, a lot of Hollywood stars, Jane Seymour, they're all there. We're presenting this, and you're mixing with these people. You know, was that happiest, or was it just amazing? You know, I mean, happiness really starts off maybe on the first day that you make your first shoe. So, yeah, maybe I was happiest then. I don't know. Happiest, I'd like to think I was happy for most of the time I was happy. I just happened to have some very, well, low moments in life, which you do get. But, yeah, I did so many things, and it's amazing. I think experiences, but I was always happy. When we got 5 stars, Aztec got 5 stars in Runner's World, and that was the hook that got us into America. Again, you know, maybe that was the happiest moment, you know. And when somebody told me, oh, we've overtaken Nike, we've overtaken Adidas, you're now number one. We were numero uno, according to Sports Goods Intelligence. Wow, you know. But you know, we've been climbing that mountain so rapidly. We've been going so fast, keeping up with the business, that it really is hard to say the happiest. Probably the whole 30 years. I was happy for 30 years, apart from a few very poor, bad moments. But otherwise, yeah, what a journey. I enjoyed it all.
What a journey, and such a well described in the book Shoemaker. Everybody who's listening, you gotta go and get a copy of Shoemaker. But on the topic that you shared, actually we have a question from Juan Yankov, that's related to the other part of the story. You know, you said happiness, but also the moments of struggle. So the question is, Juan is saying, hi Joe, and thank you for the inspiring words. What kept you motivated through all these moments of failure? And was there a time when you were closed down to give up or start something else? And I just want to add here what I read in the book, what I listened to in the book. There were a few, I'm not going to spoil it, but there were a few really, really difficult moments that you share in the book. And how did you actually pick yourself up and kept going and kept motivated with all the adversity?
Well, thanks for the question, Ewan. Yeah, it was a long journey. It was, I think I spent 31 years in total, but 20 years were real hard and suffering. And some of the times, I think how you keep going, how I kept motivated was when, on most of those occasions, I was the problem. I had maybe overstepped. Maybe I'd taken us too far too soon. Certainly with the distribution, when our distributor went out of business in the UK, that nearly killed us. I think you keep going because you have a responsibility. Yeah, we had a team, we had people, you know, we had things to do. You don't give up. Now that, and it's looking at some of these real problems as more of just something to get around, just something in the way. It's the ambition is to keep going forward, and you know, if you keep pushing the door, keep pushing for things, you will find that sometimes the door opens onto a precipice. Sometimes you could fall off, and it's dangerous, but you know, you can't stop pushing. So I think what keeps you going is to know that you know, we didn't fail on everything. Okay, this is a bad one. I nearly put us out of business at one time. But on making the decision, it was the right decision at the time. Events happened to change it, and it turned out to be not a good decision. But then again, the changes, I was even able to turn around and go to the reason why we changed and the people who were involved, and that helped. So, you know, there's always something. If you're honest, again, let's say, if you have integrity, I think that with that integrity, you know full well that, you know, whatever the mistake is, whatever the problem. And yeah, I can say that lots of things, because maybe I was over eager, over energized to do it, get on with it, you know, to jump on the next plane, to get whatever. I think when you are an entrepreneur, you become over eager to do things. Maybe you see an opportunity and maybe you don't see the trap. But you know, that's what we were saying before. Don't listen to too much advice, because if you saw the trap before doing it, you wouldn't do it. And doing it, yeah, maybe at the time it was a problem and failure, but again, you learn something. It's another lesson in life, and it's another way of moving forward. So always it's a matter of moving forward, and the motivation comes from inside. Plus the fact that people look at you and they're looking at you for guidance. They oh, Joe, find an answer. You think, well, do people believe that? Take a deep breath and get on with it.
Beautiful. Joe, I hope you have 5 more minutes. We have another definitely. Question.
Yes. Yep.
Beautiful. So Daria is having a question. Daria Nairinova, and it's, first of all, she says, thank you for these super inspiring and interesting words, Joe. I'm curious, what is your personal trait that helped you the most to achieve everything you have until now?
I think for me, it's understanding what goes on around. I think that if you listen to the noise, you hear the answers. There's a lot of noise that goes on around. If you try to be the one who pushes everything, you're not listening, you're not picking up on the people who know a lot more than you do and how you can use that. So I think it's being, while I say in the early days, don't listen to too much advice, listen to what's going on around you. It's different. It's not advice. This is listening to the noise. Now, where do you move? We went to America, and I knew it needed an American to really make that work. So Paul Fireman made that work. No good me just going, I'm here now. I'm in America. I'm going to run this up. No. Paul Fireman, an American, he needed to run the operation, and he did successfully. I went on building the distribution. And I can say it's good that you can listen to things, especially when you get in that position that you can be an influencer yourself. You're influencing the company, but listen to the other people around. Because, you know, I knew in 1989 when I got out of the business, we were $4 billion business nearly. Yeah, that's up to, we had a dozen lawyers, a dozen accountants, and people in between doing everything. The challenge at that point had gone. It needed somebody else. It needed a Paul Fireman to take it that next step. So, you know, it's know your limitations and just say, well, there are so many people now that, you know, I don't need to influence. But it's funny, even though I retired, the telephone calls kept coming. Joe, what happened here? You know, can you come across? And yeah, so I've always kept that relationship and association with the brand. And again, we asked, why do you write a book? Well, you write a book because a lot of opinions, you know, start taking the brand in so many, came from so many different directions. It has a really good history. And as you've seen in the book, I think it's a good story. I enjoyed writing it, and I hope people learn that it's very simple. You know, it's integrity. It's making sure that you know, you're there to be talked to. It's like when you put somebody on and somebody's doing a job with it, you get on with that, and don't bring me your problems. And I didn't want people to bring me the problems. You know, you're in charge. You do it. And if you want to have a talk, fine. If you have a problem, fine. But, you know, bring me answers. And so if somebody has a problem, well, which answer should I use? Yeah, we'll talk over which should be the answer. But I'm not going to solve your problems. So it's allowing people that independence, that individuality. And it you know, that way people value and you value them.
And this is the final question. I'm just very curious. I had we had the David Allen from Getting Things Done on the podcast, and he spoke about, he phrased this kind of a ambient anxiety, he likes to say it, silencing the ambient anxiety in your mind. And entrepreneurs out there that are passionate, that are driven, I can relate myself. We have so many ideas, right? And unresolved things, and you're jumping around. And how do you yourself, how do you deal with that? How do you calm yourself when you're feeling overwhelmed and your mind is running on too high of a frequency, and you need to kind of cool down a little bit? What do you do when you're feeling overwhelmed and full of so many things, and you need to kind of cool down so you can take a proper decision?
Well, I'm not a runner, but this was a good thing about running and about just going out to get fit. I think that you can put your shoes on, go to where you prefer to go. And I'm talking years ago. I don't need to do that now. In fact, I can't run now. But I used to be able to run maybe 4 or 5 miles. And, you know, when you just run, your mind goes wherever. It just drifts. And you get to the end of the run and sometimes think, oh, where have I been? I don't remember. Because your mind is just released. And during that time, you know, you get to the point where you say, well, why? What are you worrying about? What is it? Yeah, you do recognize that as you relax and you go out running, and running has been historically, running has been a good thing that I could do, just go out training and allow your mind to just relax. Because that way, if you just sit down and just try and think about all your problems, I don't think you ever answer them. Yeah, and some of the time, you've just got to sit back and allow them to answer themselves, because you're not there to answer all the questions and all the problems. Yeah, you have a lot of people, and a lot of the people will help. But if you want to unload your mind, yeah, I suggest just do some sport. Just do something that go out and try and get a bit of fitness, because it's surprising how much life is easier when you feel fitter. You might have to get fit for doing an event, but if you feel fitter, life is much easier. Yeah, you're breathing better, you're feeling better, and if you feel good, so exercise. And I guess really my reason, exercise is good. It lets you relax.
It's crazy how sometimes you're so much in your head with your problems, and then you go for a run or go for a walk, and you come back and it is completely different place where you see the problem from, and the frequency of your mind is in a different place that you can actually take, you know, find solutions and so on. Thank you so much, Joe, for sharing this. I want to ask you just the sort of like the final thing. There's many people watching now, listening right now, excited to hear more about the book. So could we remind them, where can they find the book, which is actually coming out today? The paperback is coming out today. Maybe for the last time, Joe, you can show us the copy of the book. And
I can indeed. I can show you a copy of the book. Here it is. And it is. If you have Amazon, you can get it from Amazon, or go on to our website, which is www.jwfosterheritage.com. And you can even arrange to have a signed copy. So that we can
there
do.
You go, guys.
And it comes out today.
The book is brilliant. You should definitely get a copy. Get one for your team. Get one for your business partners. It's a book filled with personal lessons, professional lessons, leadership advice, and the real story, not the story that you're going to find online on Wikipedia or somewhere else, but the real story of how Joe built with his brother this iconic global brand. Thank you so much for everybody for being with us, for listening to this podcast. And of course, thank you, Joe, for making the time, for sharing from the heart, and being with us today.
It's a pleasure, Stoyan. And we like the right stories to be learned about a product like Reebok. We like people to understand. So the book is there. And thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to say, please, go buy it. Let's get it to number one.
Let's get it to number one, guys. Share the book, share the link, not just buy the book, share a link to the book, send it to three of your friends, and let's make this book a global iconic brand, as was and it is the brand of Reebok. So thanks to everybody for watching and for listening to the podcast, and see you again at the next episode of Productivity Mastery Podcast.
Bye-bye. Thank you.